we think about it, God, relationships are something that are difficult. I mean, relationships are something that, you know, we weren't necessarily born with this relational intelligence, this ability to always know what to do. And yet, God, we're so relationally wired. Today, God, we're gonna ask that you'll help unpack some truths for us today, that you will, as we look to the Bible, as we look to Scripture, God, that you'll help us to see how you designed us to live. God, we want to hear from you today. We want to clearly hear your heart. And so I'm going to ask, God, that my words will come through clearly, reflecting your heart and your character, we pray. Amen. You know, when Jesus was walking on this earth, he was really clear about one thing. And he was really clear about a number of things. There's one thing that he was asked repeatedly about, and then there was one particular time when he was kind of put in a corner. He was like, you know, if you could sum up everything that has ever been said in the Scriptures, all the way back through the Old Testament, what would that one thing be? And Jesus, he wasn't fazed by this at all. In fact, he reached way back into the Old Testament, and he kind of pulled out and he said, this is it right here. And we've been looking at this each and every week from Mark chapter 12. This is what Jesus said when he was asked that question. He said, you should love the Lord your God with all of your heart, with all of your soul, with all of your mind, with all of your strength. So we get this idea that God is interested in every aspect of our whole person. I mean, it's not just our spiritual life, but our physical, emotional, mental, our social. And then he goes on. He says it's equally important here. The second is this. Love your neighbor as yourself. And so he says, there is no commandment that's greater than these. And so Jesus is like, part of it can be summed up in this sense of how we love God. I mean, it's this vertical relationship that we have. And then the other part of it can be summed up in how we love others, which is the horizontal dynamic. I mean, part of how we love God is how we love the people that we interact with, that we're wired to be a part of their lives in. And so Jesus, he understood something. What Jesus understood is this, that life is lived in the context of relationships. Right? I mean, think about that for a moment. I mean, this is the central theme of all of life, and Jesus understood this, is that life is lived in the context of relationships. I mean, whether that relationship be a parent-child relationship, whether that be with your parent or with your children, if you have children, whether that is a marriage relationship, whether that's a dating relationship, whether that's a friendship, whether that's with a coworker in the office, whether this is a relationship if you're in school with the people that you engage with at school, whether it's a team that you're a part of or that you're on or that you lead. I mean, life is meant to be lived in the context of relationships. And then we think vertically. I mean, God designed us vertically to live in the context of a relationship with Him, with God. And so life is lived in this context. And so we also know this at Crosspoint. We understand that as we try to seek and pursue God, as we try to understand who Jesus is and what it means to follow Him, we understand that this is often worked out in relationships. And so here at Crosspoint, we have these things called the hills that we die on. They're kind of like values, but values don't hold these teeth. I mean, we call them hills that we die on because these are the things that kind of drive our community. These are the things that we say we will go to bat for these things because this is how we understand life. And one of those things is called doing life together, because we believe that's a part of what it means to be a biblically functioning community. Without that, we would be missing something. And so, maybe you're a part of a life together group where you do life together with other people. These are things that happen in the community, in homes during the week, in coffee shops during the week. These are the places where we go and we begin to be known by other people, where we are known by other people. It's where we can go and find a sense of belonging, and others join groups and they sense that this is a community where I'm accepted for exactly who I am. And what we understand is if we want to grow and get all that God designed for us, then we have to live in the context of relationships. This is a great context to start in. But it's not just that. If we want to integrate into our lives places where we can fully understand what it means for us to live the way God designed, where we can explore the way God designed us to live, it's in these contexts. It's in contexts where we're doing life together. We're intimately connected. Because life is lived in the context of relationships. And so this morning, I want to talk about a couple of the key principles or a couple of key things that apply to all relationships, because God isn't just concerned with our spiritual life. Our spiritual life is woven into our relational life, and there's certain ways He designed us to interact and to live that enhance and give us healthy relationships. And so the first thing I want us to look at is this. It's this word that none of us like. It's the word called submission. All right? Because if we're really honest, I mean, who of us would have shown up today if we said, this week is about submission? I mean, it's about submission. I mean, who likes to submit to things, right? I mean, when do you submit to something? Most of you would rather show up today and hear about how you need to give 20% of your income than to hear about what it means to submit, right? Because when you submit, I mean, when we submit, submitting is for people who like do this in a moment of weakness when there is nothing left that you can do. I mean, when you're like at the end of your rope, but there are no other options, you submit, right? It's just for the weak, or it's when you have a moment of stupidness, right? And you're like, I'm going to submit to you because there's no other options in this moment. I mean, who voluntarily submits themselves to someone or to something? Well, the answer is those who understand that this is a key part of understanding healthy relationships, not only with others, but in our relationship with God. And so I want us to just recognize as we kind of begin to talk about this idea of submission this morning that this is not something that most of us have ever understood or done well. All right? I mean, when you think of your life, how often as you think through, you know, the last week or two or three of your life, how often have you submitted well? Have you lived a life of submission, whether that's to someone else in your life or to God? I mean, it's not something we do well, and yet we see it throughout the entire Bible. I mean, we see it all throughout the Scriptures. So let's take a look at a few of these examples and kind of try to understand what they mean for us. Ephesians chapter 5, we find Paul talking here, and he's talking about what it means to submit. In fact, this is what he says. He says, "Submit to one another out of reverence for Christ." Now, if you lead anything, I mean, if you lead anything in your business, if you lead anything in your work life, if you lead a team of people, if you lead something here at Crosspoint, if you have a group of people that you're over in some way, if you're a leader in your family, if you've led any kind of segment in any type of organization, you know that no matter what you do, if someone's not a part of the decision-making process when big decisions are made, they will distrust the decision that you came to, right? I mean, we generally, if we're not a part of the decision-making process, we generally distrust. So if you lead anything, you know that there's an enormous amount of evidence that you got to begin to create to convince someone that the decision you made was the right decision if they weren't a part of the conversation, right? Because as Americans, think about this, as Americans, we generally and naturally distrust, right? When it comes to authority, we generally distrust and don't just believe that the best interest was considered. I mean, it's the way, it's the American way. It's the way of rebellion. It's the way of distrust. And, you know, I fall prey to this as well. I mean, in the last week, in our family dynamics and in our extended family, my mom had to make a decision to move our grandmother from a nursing home facility to a different nursing home facility. A number of things that went into that, a number of things that we began realizing were not good. And she just kind of decided to make this decision. And she was explaining to me where she was moving to. She's saying things like, you know, when you drive in, you'll get to see llamas and you'll get to see pigs and there's some ducks walking around. And I'm like, did you check her into a barn? I mean, where exactly did you take her? I mean, I'm thinking like, what is this place? And so, you know, I got out to take the kids out this week and go visit her. And as I'm driving up, it's kind of this weird little place that you're driving in. And in a matter of 30 seconds, I'm thinking, what in the world was she thinking when she checked her in here? I mean, and I began to think about what I'm thinking, and in 30 seconds, in a matter of 30 seconds, I'm beginning to make decisions based on what I thought, at least, was reality, or in a certain sense, the sense that I came to rational conclusions, at least according to me, of what the right decision was to be made. Because there was a sense that in a small period of time, I immediately began to distrust that she had my grandmother's best interest in mind. I mean, this is a sign of my distrust and rebellion in relationships. And what I began to realize is that as I walked into the facilities, I began to interact with my grandmother, she was in a whole different place than she'd been. I mean, she was at peace. She was enjoying what she was doing and the people that she was with. They were caring for her. They were laughing with her. I mean, it was like she had a whole different demeanor. And I began to think through, you know, my mom has been invested in this situation for like most of the last 3 weeks. I mean, she's been making all kinds of decisions, meeting with people, talking with attorneys. I mean, she had my grandmother's best interest in mind, and yet in 30 seconds, based on what I thought was right, I could come in and begin to question and doubt. I mean, it's amazing how quickly we fall prey to distrusting decisions that are made when we're not there. I mean, whatever happened to people trusting people when a decision was made, or whatever happened to us putting ourselves under authority? I mean, it's something we don't do well. Now let's take a look at a number of scriptures here, a number of places where we find all throughout the scriptures that this word submit comes up. And so 1 Peter chapter 2, take a look at it here. This is an interesting passage. It's got a lot of emotion built into it. And so it says right here that slaves, submit yourselves to your masters with all respect. Not only to those who are good and considerate, but also to those who are harsh. For it is commendable if a man bears up under pain of unjust suffering because he is conscious of God. Now, people have used and abused this verse for years to justify slavery. And so this is not the kind of slavery that we had in the first number of centuries here in our country. This isn't the kind of slavery where you go over to another country and you kidnap somebody's family member and then you bring them back to your country to bolster your economy so you can have a better way of life. This isn't the kind of slavery that's being talked about here in Peter. And so what's being talked about here is what's probably referred to as debtor slavery. I mean, this is the context here. And debtor slavery is this idea where you voluntarily put yourself in slavery to someone else. else, not with chains, not where this person's being beaten and it's this dark thing. This is debtor slavery, where somebody basically has a debt that they owe to someone. So they say, I'm going to voluntarily submit myself to you, and I'm going to work for a wage so that I can pay my way out of debt. And so when we think about this and we understand this context, it's actually closer to an employee-employer relationship, similar to when we say, you know, I have bills, I have needs, I have ways I have to provide for my family. I'm going to submit myself to my employer, and then I'm going to make a wage so that I can take care of my responsibilities. And so the Bible's saying, even when you have a difficult employer, it says that you should submit yourself. I mean, when it's not difficult, you should submit yourself. But even if it's somebody who's difficult to work with, in the relational context here, you should submit yourself to them. And when you do this, you honor authority. This is what the Bible says. You're being conscious of authority. You're being conscious of God. Here's another one, Romans chapter 13. Take a look at what this says. It says, everyone must submit himself to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except that which God has established. And so God is basically saying here that he establishes a hierarchy. There's a certain pecking order, a certain hierarchy to society. And God says that I like that, basically. Because God's saying, this is the way I've put things, I've organized the world to work. And it's what's interesting here is, you know, sometimes we see people in leadership and we're like, well, they shouldn't be in that position. Maybe they abuse their leadership position. God is not saying that everyone deserves the leadership position that they've been in. Or God's not saying that just because you have elected officials, he's not saying that that was the best person that could fill the job, because when we have elections, that's at the call of the people. God's not always saying that those people are the best people for the job. What God's saying is that when there's an office, that this is something that God has put into place in order to govern the world, in order to put order to how the world works. Therefore, we ought to submit ourselves to the authorities, to people. This is God's idea. Take a look at the next one here in Hebrews chapter 13. It says, obey your leaders and submit to their authority. They keep watch over you as men who must give an account. Obey them so that your work will be a joy, not a burden, for that would be of no advantage to you. And so what this is saying is, when you obey somebody in authority, that who benefits? I mean, who benefits when you obey someone that's in authority? You benefit, and I benefit. I mean, think about this for a moment. If you lead anybody, if you have people that you oversee, if you understand what we're kind of talking about here, because if you have people that report to you, understand that when someone obeys authority, when there's certain things, you say, this is how life is supposed to go, this is how your job is supposed to work, this is what we're going to be doing. When that actually happens, your life is better, and the person in authority's life is better. I mean, this is, you know, so many times it goes back to this idea of distrusting, whether it be a job relationship, whether it be somebody in our personal lives, a friendship relationship. Whenever we're second guessing somebody's decisions, whenever we have that sense of constantly wanting to be heard. I was in a relationship this week in a conversation where, you know, this phrase kept coming out. I just want to be heard. I just want to be heard. Well, there comes a point where you got to say, I've been heard and I need to move on. All right? And so whenever we're here, and whenever there's a constant doubting and a hurling of accusations within an organization, whatever organization it might be, then it just sucks the life out of you. And you're not actually able to lead in the way you were designed to lead. I mean, what this is saying here is that you should be a joy to your boss if you're employed. I mean, if you're employed, you have somebody in authority over you, you should be a joy to them. Right, it's saying that if you're a team leader, it's to your advantage when your employees understand this, because when your life is a joy, then their life is much more joyful, right? So I mean, there's a benefit to both. This is what the writer of Hebrews is saying here. I was thinking about what this means for me. I was thinking about how this breaks down in my life and some of those places where I have to submit to authority. I thought, you know, I don't live in my parents' home anymore. I mean, so I don't submit myself to my parents. I honor them. I mean, there's this interesting dynamic that takes place. You move out of your parents' home, you no longer submit to them, but you begin to honor them, which is drastically different. And so I'm not there, and I began to look and think, where are the places I submit? And I began to think back to my role here at Crosspoint. I thought, you know, here at Crosspoint, of authority figures, I'm at the top. I mean, I don't have anybody looking over my shoulder on a day-to-day basis, kind of telling me what to do. I'm at the top of that organizational chart, and yet I have people that I submit to. We have this thing called a governance team, and they're kind of our board of directors in a sense, and they're somebody that they're kind of our spiritual directors here at Crosspoint, and while they give spiritual direction to this community, I'm a part of that board, but I also submit to them. And so there are things that at times they decide, and then I have to submit to those things. And so I was trying to think, you know, what was one of those last decisions, one of those places recently that maybe we were in conversation and something came out in a way that was different than what I expected and I had to submit to them. One of those things that was maybe difficult or hard. And I was thinking back to when we began the hiring process and began to add staff to the CrossPoint team. There was a conversation about benefits that we began to have. How are we going to put benefits in place? How are we going to put vacation time in place? And what we kind of began to talk about was how we were going to tier the benefit package. And as we were talking about this, somebody on our team said, you know, I think all of the paid staff members at CrossPoint should have the same amount of vacation time. And you know, you've been in that situation, and if you're in a leadership role, you're kind of like, whoa, there's something about the head leader having more time, and maybe it's because I was in that role. You know, I should have more time than the rest of the staff that work under me. I mean, you know, I'm being honest with you, okay? You're like, Kurt's a jerk. He's got to be a terrible person to work for. This is my thinking, all right? I'm like, you know, there's something about this being tiered. You need to work yourself up toward, you know, the maximum level of vacation. And yet, as I heard this, I asked a few questions, and then eventually I came to this point. I said, you know, I can go with that, because what I began to realize was that the heart of this team's responsibility is to look out for the best interest of CrossPoint, the best interest of me as the leader, and the best interest of our team members. And as I began to hear them talk, I began to realize that when they're submitting this, they're saying, we want healthy leaders at CrossPoint. And if it means that we give them more time, if we give equal time so that everybody can have times away, everybody can have times where they're refreshed and they can come back and they're more energized, they're more focused, we believe that is in the best interest of the mission that CrossPoint's about. And while it didn't set well for the first 15 or 20 minutes as I'm wrestling through, because that hadn't been the framework that I'd come from, I began to say, you know, I want to submit to that, because I see that's in the long-term best interest of what we're doing here. Here's the deal. Here's what submission is right here. Regardless of the relationship, submission is when you are sub to the mission. Think about that for a moment. I mean, if you're in a role at your work with your employer, with your boss, submission is when you say, I'm going to put myself below the mission that our organization is a part of. I'm sub to the mission. If I'm in a marriage relationship, it means that if our goal is to have a healthy family, a healthy marriage relationship, raising healthy children, I have needs that I can easily say, this is what I need, this is what I want. I'm going to submit myself because I'm going to be sub to the mission. I'm going to say, there's something greater than just what I want and I need at this time. And when you begin to think this way, when you begin to apply this to your relationships, you begin to realize that being sub to the mission is difficult. Because what it means is that my agenda isn't always first. And yet when you think about the relationships that you're in, whenever you run into these moments where there's difficulty in relationships, when do they begin to enter tension? When we begin to not be sub to the mission. Let's take a look at one more here. Matthew chapter 19. In Matthew chapter 19, we find Jesus, we see Jesus here talking about the context of marriage, and yet in this context, the kind of principle that he pulls out here is something that applies to all relationships, and yet he chooses to kind of pull it out in this really emotionally charged situation. For we have these Pharisees, we have these religious leaders, and they're coming to Jesus and they're asking him, they're actually trying to test him, they're trying to kind of get him in a corner, as they're always trying to do. And so the question, it says, some of the Pharisees came to him to test him, and they asked him, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any and every reason? And he says, haven't you read, he replied, that at the beginning the Creator made them male and female, and he said, for this reason a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. So they're no longer two, but one. Therefore, what God has joined together, let man not separate. And so what's going on here is they're kind of saying, you know, Jesus, they're making a reference back to when Moses was basically kind of making conditions for when divorce was permissible. So this is much about marriage as it is divorce. And Jesus is kind of reaching back and he's saying, basically, there's two vows to the marriage relationship. There's two vows that a husband and wife enter into. The first is a vow of loyalty. A man will leave his father and mother, and his first allegiance will now shift to his new family, to his spouse. It's the vow of loyalty. It means this person, this relationship is now first among everything. And then there's another vow in this statement that Jesus makes. It's a vow of intimacy. That when this happens, the two will become one flesh. So there's this intimacy that's going to be experienced in this relationship that's different than any other relationship. And he says this is what happens in a marriage relationship. It's not just a sexual thing that the two become one, but it's a physical thing. It's an emotional thing. It's a mental thing. It's your stuff is more and more my stuff. It's your dreams are more and more my dreams. There's a merging. There's a oneness that begins to take place. It's the two vows of marriage, the vow of loyalty, the vow of intimacy. And so the question is, why then did Moses command that divorce could happen? And Jesus is like the smartest guy that ever walked the earth. I mean, he picks up immediately on the language here. Notice the word commit there, or command. They say, why then did Moses command? And Jesus is like, he didn't command anything. And notice what Jesus says here. It says, Jesus replied, Moses permitted. Right? And commanding something and permitting something is drastically different. He says, Moses permitted you to divorce your wives because your hearts were hard. And so why do we struggle to submit? Why do we struggle to submit to our bosses? Why do we struggle to submit to our spouses? Why do we struggle to submit in times when friends come to us and they're like, hey, you know, I'm noticing this. And you're like, there's no way. I'm not submitting to that. This is what I want. This is what I need. Why do we struggle? Jesus lays it out right here. He says, because your hearts are hard. That's an interesting key right here. Because this word, your hearts are hard, is kind of the word hard-heartedness in the scriptures. And I want to kind of break it down for you, because in the Greek language, this word hard-heartedness actually is the word cardia and sclero. And so the word cardia is obviously heart, right? I mean, with cardiologists, we understand that has something to do with the heart. The word sclero has to do with this idea of something drying up or hardening and becoming tough. And so you put the two words together, and this is where we get the word arteriosclerosis. I mean, this hardening of the arteries around the heart. It's when hard-heartedness, it's the same word Jesus uses to define why our relationships deteriorate. And Jesus is saying, basically, Moses never commanded for divorce. But he said, there are times when your hearts become so hard that there is no way that a relationship can become restored. He says, you know, there's a lot of big things that can happen. I mean, there's a lot of misconceptions. People think that, you know, if I have an affair, well, that's just a right for me to divorce my spouse. And actually, the scriptures teach the opposite. It says we should live out of grace. And so our first response is to give the person the chance to repent and be restored to the relationship. And he says, if that doesn't happen, and if the other person, the person who violated the relationship, if their heart is hard and they're not willing to submit and become tender and pliable, because Jesus basically says hard-heartedness is what was once flexible and tender and pliable has now become inflexible. If their hearts are hard and there's no way that they're willing to submit and say, and own what they did and say, this is where I messed up. I want to be restored. I want to restore this relationship. He says, well, then at this case, this is where divorce is permitted. And so we know how this works, right? I mean, our hearts have a tendency to grow hard. I mean, we're going to use the marriage relationship here to kind of illustrate this, but it happens in all of our relationships. I mean, those of you that are married, those of you that have been married, those of you that want to be married, you've seen the picture of this. We all know how it works in the courtship days. It's like you have a tender heart. I mean, you know, it's like when you're dating, you want to carry her books home from class. You want to go and sit for like 3 hours hearing every detail of her day. I mean, you're like, tell me more. Explain this to me. Could you please tell me this? And then you go on the honeymoon and you carry her bags for her. And then you enter your home for the first time and you carry her across the threshold. And as soon as you get inside, you begin to get this condition that's like a back problem. And 6 months later, when she says, I'd like to move the couch from this side of the room to that side of the room, you say, let me know when it's there and I'll tell you how it looks, right? I mean, it's like this, our hearts, which was once pliable and tender and moldable and flexible, over a matter of a couple of months, begin to move toward inflexibility. They begin to become rigid and hard. I mean, this is hard-heartedness. In the early days, we find ourselves longing to serve. I mean, we find ourselves, you know, if there's a conflict, we will stay up all night until we get it resolved. In the later days, we roll over and face the other way or go to the couch. Because our hearts are hard. We don't want there to be any distance or breach. And, you know, we find ourselves always wanting to give the benefit of the doubt, right? I was in a conversation with one of my brothers this week, and this is one of our brothers who lives a little further away from us, and a couple of us in conversation with him. And it was basically, you know, kind of some things that became barriers in our relationship that we needed to work through. And one of the things that I noticed as we were talking, as we were saying, why did you say this? And what did you mean by that? Was that we were failing to give one another the benefit of the doubt. I mean, it's amazing when you hear something and you just immediately, it's like we immediately begin to make an assumption on where they're coming from. Why are we failing to give the benefit of the doubt? Because our hearts had become hard. And as we began to soften, as we began to understand, as we began to become pliable, we began to be able to work through understanding where one another was at. I mean, our hearts become hard. Instead of seeking to serve, we want to be served. Instead of seeking reconciliation, we blame. Instead of confessing, you know, yes, I did this, we begin to try to point out the personality flaw in the other person. It's like, well, if you would have done this, then I wouldn't have had to do this. I mean, it's like we begin. It's like a coffee cup left out on the counter becomes a major personality flaw. I mean, it's like, how could you have done this? Because our hearts become hard. And so what begins to happen is we begin to take these tiny little exits. I mean, in a marriage relationship, as our hearts get harder, we take these tiny little exits, exits from oneness. Now, divorce is a big exit. It's a big step out. But before that big exit ever happens, there are all of these little exits, these little steps away from oneness, these little moments where we say, instead of working that out, I'm just going to step back and begin to question you. These little moments where I begin to question your intention in doubt, where I don't give you the benefit of the doubt, and all of these little steps away, you multiply them by 12, by 100, by 1,000 times, and all of these little exits eventually take you out of oneness. And that's very true for the marriage relationship, but if we think about it, hard-heartedness is usually at the center of all of our relational struggles. And so let's take a look at the rest of Nathan and Katie's story and see how they work this out.
God has been speaking to us, for a couple of weeks before that. It seemed like everywhere I turned, somebody was asking me, are you guys in church? And when we got there, it was almost as if Christ just walked to our pew in the aisle and just slapped us both across the face and said, I brought you here. I've walked you to the front door. What more do you want?
I still had not told him what I had done.
She woke up one morning just bawling. I asked her what was wrong, and she said, I can't tell you, I can't tell you.
It was though God told me that in order for me to be able to move on, to be able to grow, and to be able to repair our relationship, that I was going to have to tell him.
In the back of my mind, I knew exactly what she had to tell me. I just didn't know who or when or why.
It was like he assured me that then he would make our relationship wonderful beyond even my comprehension.
So we sat in my truck, and she spilled her guts and told me everything about it, and told her that Jesus had been telling her that she needs to tell me this. And at that moment, Christ told me, tell your wife what you've been doing, because you two can forgive each other, and I can make your marriage something awesome. She reacted completely different than I thought she would. She just looked at me and said, I forgive you.
Without Jesus, I think that we would be divorced right now.
We're not moving laterally to each other. We're moving centrally towards God, and that's bringing us close together. And that's something that I love from the bottom of my heart.
Jesus cares about relationships. And as we've been wrestling through this series, we've been talking about every element of our life that Jesus cares about. We've been trying to make these physical, tangible connects. And today, we believe that God wants to meet us wherever we are in our relationships that need restored. Now, whether it be a relationship with a boss, with a coworker, with a family member, with a brother, with a sister, with a spouse. And when the Hebrew slaves were wandering in the wilderness, the text back in Exodus and in Numbers says that there was a cloud by day and a pillar of fire by night that hovered over them wherever they went. And these words here, this idea here, this concept here is in the Hebrew language, this idea of Shekinah or Shekinah. It was this idea of glory. Those words mean glory. And so the idea was that the Shekinah or the Shekinah glory of God was hovering over His people wherever they went. And the belief was that as God literally hovered over His people as they traveled through the wilderness, that God hovers over a man and a woman when they enter a marriage relationship, when they share those vows with one another. I'm going to have John Tammy come up here and illustrate this for us. Because in ancient Jewish traditions, the belief was that whenever a couple would come together and begin to share their vows, their wedding party would have this thing called a prayer shawl. And they would make it like a canopy, and they would literally hang it up over the couple as they stood under it and made their vows to one another. And the idea here was that God was literally hovering, the hovering presence, the hovering glory of God was with them in this moment. And oftentimes, even during that, it would slowly just drift and hit the back of their neck, the back of their head, because we're physical, tangible people. And we need to know that God is there and He's hovering. And so for hundreds and hundreds of years, this canopy has been used to hover over relationships as a sign of God's physical presence. So we kind of wrap this up today as we think about our relationships, as we think about relationships we struggle with, if there are any of those in our lives right now, those with a spouse, with a boss, with a friend, with a family member. As you think about your marriage, if you're married, can God heal your marriage? I mean, are there all these little exits that are taking place that are just causing you to, maybe there's no big exit, but there's all these little exits because you're struggling to submit. Can you come stand under the huppah and just acknowledge the hovering presence of God and say, God, help my heart become pliable, flexible again. You know, maybe it's singleness, loneliness. Maybe you've been through a terrible breakup. Maybe you're dealing with incredibly difficult issues of sexuality, things that are just barriers relationally. Can you come and stand under the huppah and let the hovering presence of God rest on you for a moment? Saying, God, I want to submit. I want my heart to be soft again. Whatever healing and restoring needs to take place right now, that's what I need. Maybe you've been struggling with a relationship with your boss, with a coworker, with somebody who's over you at work, and you're struggling to submit to their authority, and your heart has become hard. Can you come and stand, and can God's hovering presence begin to soften your heart? I'm going to invite you to stand with me. As we sing here in just a moment, John and Tammy are going to move to the front of the aisle. In fact, you guys can move that way right now. As we sing, maybe you would like to come and just stand under this huppah. Maybe today is a day where you say, I'm not gonna be hard-hearted anymore. If it's with your spouse, you want to just come hand in hand and stand for a moment. This doesn't solve everything, but the hovering presence is John and Tammy drape this huppah over you for just a moment. Nothing will be said to you. They'll say a quiet prayer in their minds as you stand there. But maybe you need this physical, tangible sense that God is here. He's hovering in my life. And He seeks to restore and repair and renew. And so as we sing, if this is what you need, we invite you to come and stand under the huppah. As it's lifted, you're ready to turn to your seat. Let's sing together.